Hey, welcome to Hope. Glad that you are all here. There's not much more room upstairs. Might want to do a little squishy squish. Can we do a squishy squish? Love thy neighbor. That means move in. Just squeeze them nice and tight. I'm sure they showered this year sometime. Looks like we need a little room. It's really mostly upstairs. You guys downstairs, you're just doing it because you like each other. But upstairs looks like there's a little crammage. I love those seats back there, up back there. They are the worst seats in the world, but people love those seats for some reason or other. I guess they just want to sit where they can not hear any or see anything. Welcome. Welcome to Hope. We are in a series in the book of Genesis. If you have been with us for this school year, starting in September, we started this series, took a pause on it for December, right around the middle of December or so, and then we'd always do something in the beginning of January, kind of kick off the year, and then we're now kicking it back off again. And so here we have this series right now. We're in Genesis. We've done, I believe, 12 messages as of today. Today's the 13th. We have about three more. We are not hitting every part, obviously, of all 50 chapters, verse by verse, through the book of Genesis. That's not going to happen. I know we're going to skip some of your good stories. In fact, some of the ones you love, you may even find that today in what we're going to be going through. Is it warm in here? Is it a little warm in here? Yes. Take a vote. Where's a staff person? Nathan, would you turn that fan on right back here, number 22? Turn it to on. It's the only one that doesn't say on. The rest are on. So hit that. The fans will come on. It will instantly be the perfect temperature. So we're not probably not going to do that for you. As I've gone through this so far, I've loved the book of Genesis. Genesis is an amazing book. Obviously, the first few chapters are so foundational. We talk about them often at Hope. But as I think of the things that have been impactful for me, just little phrases or little accounts that we went. The one week we gave a message, and it was basically I showed the clip from Billy Crystal's movie Urban Cowboy. That's not it. City Slickers is something like Urban Cowboy. That's a totally different movie. But the best and worst day. And remember, it started off with his worst day, and that was the day when his father, Abraham, was tested in his faith, where God said to him, take your son, your only son, whom you love. It's interesting how he, you know, really hones in on letting Abraham know what's going on here. Take your son, your only son, the one whom you love, Isaac, just so we're getting real specific here who I'm talking about, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on a mountain I will show you, right? Now, we're not going to go into how he knew that that was not just, you know, too much desert air or something, that he really did know that that was God. We're just taking that assumption that God was actually testing him. And so the part that amazes me on this is not so much, this test is amazing. But the part that amazes me is the next verse. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and loaded his donkey to go, not to run, to go. And it just totally floors me how he did that early in the morning. I don't know if he didn't sleep all night, so he just was trying to get going or what, but it was this act of, God, I trust you. I trust you in the midst of all kinds of things. That was Abraham's best moment. Isaac, very scary day, probably needed some counseling for a few years after this whole account. But then it becomes Isaac's, that leads up later to Isaac's best day. And that's the day that he gets the wife from the well. If you remember the account, Abraham sends his servant ahead. The servant prays one of those kind of audacious prayers, hoping that God would answer, how am I supposed to know which of these women in this country I'm supposed to get for Isaac? Because I've been sent by Abraham, and it goes something like this. I just want to read portion of it, verse 14, may it be that when I say to a girl, please let down your jar that I may have a drink, and she says, drink, and I'll water your camels too, let her be the one you have chosen for my servant Isaac. By this I will know that you have shown kindness to my master. And remember, this is a big deal. It is a big deal to water camels because each camel drinks about the same as a swimming pool. No, that's not quite right, but it's a lot of water. Many gallons per camel. And so to offer to water someone's camels is quite a big deal. And so then, of course, before he finished praying, I love that phrase, before he finished praying, Rebecca came out and with her jar on her shoulder. How you doing, right? And there she is. And it goes on to describe her more, these kind of things. And then it says, the servant hurried to meet her and says, please give me a little water from your jar. And he's waiting for the answer. And she says, drink, my lord. And quickly lowered the jar in her hands and gave him a drink. After she had given him a drink, she said, I'll draw water for your camels too until they finish drinking. Oh, it's good. This is it. This is the best. Now, I love that this message. Really fun message. It was fun for me too to see the way God often answers prayers that, you know, just maybe you could come up with a better strategy how to get a wife, but you say, I got an idea. We'll just do this. And God sometimes, not always, but sometimes just honors that. When I went home after third service, I went home, and I'm not going to say who, Tim LaBerge, but somebody put on my Facebook this picture right here. And so that kind of made... that was funny. So we go from there, of Abraham to Isaac. And last week, Cor started the conversation about Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau are the sons of Isaac. So you got Abraham to Isaac, Isaac now to Jacob and Esau. But the promise is going to go through Jacob and not Esau. And you see this, Cor talked about this last week, the prophecy, the way God designed it to be. And what you're going to see today, super clear, is this has nothing to do with Jacob, because Jacob is a bum. You're a bum, Rocky. He's a bum. Just nothing to him. It's amazing if you don't see anything else. And two nations are in your womb, speaking to Rebecca. Now, two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. And you can see this played out. Cor talked about this even as they're born. Esau's born first, verse 25. The first came out, and it said, red. All his body was hairy, like a hairy cloak. I've seen a lot of babies, but, and some are hairier than others, but I mean, this one was hairy, like you just gave birth to Sasquatch. I mean, it's just, names him Esau, and afterwards his brother came out, and his hand was holding Esau's heel, so they named him Jacob. Now, Jacob, the word means, right, grasps the heel, but that's also a euphemism or figurative way of saying deceiver. Like if you grasp somebody's heel, you know, it's lost in translation for us, but that would be a way of saying you're pulling my leg. Huh? 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 I have no idea if those are the same. But maybe that's where it comes from. Could very well be, but that's where this comes from. And 60 years old when she bore him, Rebecca had them. Okay, now, you see right away that this thing doesn't start out well. Not only is there this problem of this prophecy that says that the one will serve the other and God's orchestration of those events, but also you can see this played out in their lives. The two brothers don't really get along. You can see the deception that happens when Jacob comes in to, well, let me back up here a little bit. Esau one day is starving, if you remember, and he comes in and he says, you've got something to eat there, Jacob. Can I have some of that? And he says, sell me your birthright for it. In other words, what a birthright was, the firstborn would get more of a share of the inheritance of the father than all the other sons would. And so he says, sure, what do I care? I'm going to die if I don't eat. And so he gets to eat. So he loses his birthright. But then Jacob tries to also get the blessing of the firstborn by his father. And so Rebecca wants him to do it, devises this plan, put some lamb skin or something. I remember what kind of fur it was. Put some fur on your arm. Now, that's a hairy dude in order to say, oh, that's a lamb's wool. Oh, that maybe that's Esau, you know? Isaac's eyes are bad at this time, so he's part of the, you know, plot here. And Rebecca is trying to use Jacob in this whole deception. So he went into his father, it's Jacob, he said, my father. And he said, here I am, who are you, my son? Jacob said to his father, Now, let's just count the lies. All right, here we go. This is going to be fun. I am Esau, lie. Your firstborn, lie. I have done as you've told me, which is to go get game, to go get wild game, lie. Now sit up, okay, that's the truth, and eat of my game, lie, that your soul may bless me with the blessing of the firstborn, lie. Okay, we're already done with one hand. Keep going here. But Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? You know, he went out to go get game, and he just, what, you, something around the corner there, or what was the deal? It says, because the Lord your God granted me success by going to the refrigerator and getting something. Lie. Then Isaac said to Jacob, please come near me that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you're really my son Esau or not. So just to kind of speed it up here, he does that, gives him his arm. Sure, you're, I guess you are. but he says, you sure sound a lot like Jacob. And he asks him point blank, are you really Esau? And Jacob says, I am. Now, I don't totally understand the custom. We don't have this custom anymore, the blessing of the firstborn. But somehow, lying through your teeth to get it does not nullify it. I don't totally get that, but that's the way it works. And so Esau doesn't get this blessing. When he comes in, he brings in the food that he was asked. He doesn't get it. And here's the summary then in Genesis 27. Esau says, isn't he rightly named Jacob, which means deceiver? He deceives. He has deceived me these two times. First, he took my birthright, and now he's taken my blessing. And then it says, verse 41 of chapter 27 of Genesis, Esau held a grudge against Jacob because of the blessing his father had given him. He said to himself, the days of mourning for my father, because he died, are near. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. That makes him feel better. So, today what we're going to do is we're going to cover two chapters in the life of Jacob. We're going to cover chapters 29 and 30. It goes all the way from right here all the way through chapter 36. There's amazing encounters, different things. Jacob is a complete bum. It is amazing when you look at all the different things that he does. But we want to kind of hone in on right around one event, which Jacob is very, very famous for, and that's this one. So nice, he did it twice. When asked whether or not he thought that was a courageous thing or not to marry two women, he said, no, it's big of me. I should have looked at my notes. Said after first service, don't do that joke. Second service, so. As for Tim Johnson, he loves puns. All right, now, so he marries two women. Probably the most famous in the Old Testament. There are several. All are big dogs. Abraham, Isaac. No, excuse me, not Isaac. Abraham, Jacob, David, Solomon. Many of the big dogs have this. And we'll talk about this later, this issue. Like, wait a minute. But we want to look at the life and times, and I want to look at four different scenes that happen. So we're going to read through all of chapter 29 and 30. So if you got a Bible with you, might be a good place to open up 29 and 30 of the book of Genesis. Let me just give you a little bit of background while you're doing that. In the end of chapter 27, remember what happens is Esau says, I'm going to kill him. That's what's going to happen. Rachel finds out about that and tells Jacob, Esau's going to kill you. In fact, it's a great phrase. It says, the way he's going to console himself is by killing you. So that's how Esau feels about this. It'll make me feel much better to kill this guy. So Rachel finds out about it. Oops, excuse me, Rebecca. There's too many R's. Rebecca, the mother of Jacob, finds out about it, and she warns him and says, you got to leave here. You got to leave here now. And you got to go get out of here and go to my brother. You'll be safe there. My brother Laban, he's in the country of Haran. She then deceives Isaac. So Isaac must still be living, obviously, otherwise there would be no deception here. So he doesn't die yet, he dies later, Esau goes through the mourning period, then he's going to kill Jacob. But Rebecca comes to Isaac and says, oh, I hate all these women around here. I don't want any of them for my son. Jacob has to get a wife from this other country. Isaac falls for it and says, sure, go ahead and do that. And so then he sends him out. On his way out, chapter 28, he has this dream. Maybe you've heard of the phrase Jacob's ladder. And he's having this dream about this ladder between heaven and earth, and there's angels ascending and descending on it. And it's this kind of funky dream, and he sleeps on a rock for his head. He takes the rock, and he makes a pillar out of it, calls it Bethel. Huh? Bethel? Huh? Calls it Northwestern. And there you go. And he has this encounter with God. Jacob starts to get more encounters with God. But the amazing thing, is God promises to Jacob that all the blessing that was given, promised to Abraham, given then to Isaac, would come through him. And he promises him that he'll be the guy that all of Israel is blessed through. He'll be the guy that kings will come out of. He'll be the guy. Whew! And when we see who this guy is, you're going to be blown away that really, you give this to Jacob? This is not a very good vessel to put your blessing into, and yet that's what God does. So let's start Act 1 of this four-act kind of thing. Things start out pretty puppy dogs and rainbows here. Pretty good, all right? It is interesting. I'm going to read this act just because it's the only good thing that happens, to be honest with you. It is so dark. These two chapters, as I've been studying them since Thursday, as we're looking at this week, they're just downright depressingly dark. And so I just thought we'd have to have one little puppy dog and bunny moment here. And so we're going to take a look at this. Here it is. Jacob continued on his journey, chapter 29, starting in verse 1, and came to the land of the eastern peoples. There he saw a well in the field with three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well. The stone over the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone away from the well's mouth and the water the sheep. Then they would return the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. So there's a lot of conversation about this well. So you got three different flocks there at this well, and the well has a large stone on it, and it's a stone that's difficult to move, because then they would say the shepherds, plural, would roll away this stone, and then somehow they wanted to cover the well, or they didn't want to contaminate the well, or Tupperware hadn't been invented yet, or what, or something. They could not seal this well, so use this big stone. And it says that they do this all the time, and then when they're done, they cover it back up. That's going to become significant here in a little bit. Just hang with me. Jacob asked the shepherds, "My brothers, where are you from?" "We're from Haran," they replied. "Oh, that's good. That's where I want to go." He says, "Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson?" "Yes, we know him." Then Jacob said, "Is he well?" "Yes, he is," they said. "And here comes his daughter, Rachel, with the sheep." So she's coming now with the sheep. That'll be the fourth flock there. "Look," he said, this is Jacob speaking, "the sun is still high." In other words, it's early afternoon, or perhaps it's around noontime or whatever, "and it is not time for the flocks to be gathered," which happens later in the day. "Water the sheep now and take them back to pasture." And they said, "We can't," they replied, "until all the flocks are gathered and the stone has been rolled away from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep." Some commentators think it takes a lot of us to move this stone. We're not going to do that. We only do it once. We want to wait till everybody gets here. While he was still talking with them, Rachel came with her father, verse 9, with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. When Jacob saw Rachel's daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and Laban's sheep, he went over and rolled the stone away from the mouth of the well and watered his uncle's sheep. Here's this huge stone, and what does he do? He sees her, he sees a sheep, and somebody says, "Well, which way is the well?" And he says, "That way is the well." And he goes over there and he does this feat of strength and moves it by himself, right? "Well, yes, I moved it by myself." And so he says, "Then Jacob kissed Rachel," "How you doing?" "and began to weep aloud." Really bad breath for a shepherdess. No. It's happy. "He had told Rachel that he was a relative of her father and a son of Rebekah, so she ran and told her father. As soon as Laban heard the news about Jacob, his sister Sunny hurried to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his home, and there Jacob told him all these things. Then Laban said to him, 'You are my own flesh and blood.'" And from that moment on, everything goes south. That's the highest moment of this story. Seems like, okay, great. We're being welcomed in. I moved the rock. Okay, it doesn't say move the rock back. I already impressed the girl. Got it. Okay, good. We're moving on. Everything is happy. And now it's going to get really complicated. I'm talking really complicated. This is the fine print here. It says yada, 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 yada. And you're supposed to sign it. What's going to happen between Laban and between Jacob is so complicated that you almost need a lawyer to figure it out. And I really had to read this over and over. And it's like, oh, yeah, there's the loophole. There's the loophole. You can find it. If you just look, you can find the loopholes. There's so many complicated relationships in here that it's amazing. Okay, so let's just start off and go after it. After Jacob had stayed for a whole month, so he's there for 1 month, Laban said to him, just because you are a relative of mine, should you work for me for nothing? Tell me what your wages should be. Sounds like a great guy, right? I mean, you tell me what I should pay you. Now, he's going to answer that question, but just hang with it. There's a little bit of description here first. He said, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. Now, that's an interesting way to say things, isn't it? Leah had weak eyes, but Rachel was lovely in form and beautiful. That's just weird, right? So it's basically saying there's a defect with Leah. She needed glasses, or if they didn't have glasses then. And it's saying there's a but. So she had the weak eyes, but Rachel was something else. So I think you could interpret it. I don't think it's too far to say. Leah has weak eyes. Rachel doesn't. Rachel is lovely in form and beauty, but Leah's not. Okay? Now, I know that's not always the case because I wear glasses and I'm lovely in beauty and form. Oh, dear. I had a guy whistle at me first service. You know, hubba hubba, you know? Pretty sure it was a guy. Now, here's where the plot thickens. Jacob was in love with Rachel and said, I'll work for you for 7 years in return for your younger daughter, Rachel. Remember? Yeah, it's a question. The question or statement waiting for a response is, what should your wages be? Tell me your wages, right? And the answer given is, I'll work for you for 7 years if you give me the daughter. Now, I didn't go to business school or anything like that, but you're not supposed to start a negotiation with the highest, okay? Okay, I want the girl, and I'll work 7 years. That's a really bad business deal. He should just say, what's my wages? I want to marry your daughter. Well, how about 300 years? How about one? How about 200? About two. You know, that's how negotiations are supposed to work. He doesn't. He just comes out with the worst deal ever and just says, I'll give you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Okay, so that is clear, right? That is very clear. 7 years of work, what do I get? Rachel. Clear. Look at Laban's response. Look at what he says. It's better that I give her to you than to some other man. Stay here with me. At first you read that and you go, okay, yeah, he's agreeing to it. Read that again. It's better that I give her to you than to some other man. You could argue in a court of law. I was just making a statement. The price of tea in China is 4 cents a pound. This has nothing to do with our conversation. It's better that I get. Now, you would, I mean, seriously, that's how this game is going to be played between these two over and over and over. So Jacob served 7 years to get Rachel. But they seemed like only a few days to him. Whoever's the author is just some lovesick puppy at this moment. I don't, Moses or whatever. 7 years seemed like a few days. Now, it's interesting because of what follows, right? It says, because of her love for her, they weren't just a few days, because listen what Jacob says. Jacob says to Laban, give me my wife. It's only been a few days. No, give me my wife. My time is completed, and I'm just going to cut to the chase, and I want to lie with her. Okay, I mean, it's just, back off there, big dog, you know, right? So what does Laban do? Laban, first of all, he's going to throw a big party. Brought together all the people of the place and gave a feast. I'm sure there was wine served. Lots of wine. I'm sure. Has to be. But when evening came, he took his daughter Leah and gave her to Jacob, and Jacob lay with her. And Laban gave his servant girl Zilpha to his daughter as her maidservant. So it's like a wedding gift. Now, one of my favorite verses in all the Old Testament. When morning came, there was Leah. Well, imagine that. Ladies and gentlemen, take from this, nothing good happens in the dark. Okay? I married the wrong person. It's like, oh, dear. So Jacob said to Laban, what is this you've done to me? I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Why have you deceived me? Why have you Jacobed me? I do that. You don't do that. When morning came, you got to go. I put that in by mistake. First, go to the middle, verse 26. Laban replied, it is not our custom here to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. That would have been a nice point to know 7 years ago, right? Are you kidding me? That's a little detail that maybe we would have saw if she got married off in those 7 years. Didn't happen. Now, the solution, though, is finish this daughter's bridal week, then we'll give you the younger one also in return for another 7 years of work. Now, he could say, wait a minute. We already did my 7 years of work. Why would I do another 7 years of work? But he's lovesick, and he does it. Jacob did so. He finished the week with Leah, and then Laban gave him his daughter Rachel to be his wife. Laban gave his servant girl Bilhah to his daughter, Rachel as her maidservant. Jacob lay with Rachel also, and here it is, he loved Rachel more than Leah. Sound like that cable polygamy show? And he worked, I don't know, what is the name of that show? Anybody know? Oh, you should not know the name of that. Shame on you. It was just a test. No. Sister wives? Are they sisters too? You shouldn't know the answer to that either. Wow. I didn't say Simon Says. You should. Okay. And he worked for Laban another 7 years. Okay? Wow. This is a messed up family. Now, what we're going to do next is we're going to look at this relationship that's going on. Right now, you've got Jacob. He's married to two women, Leah and Rachel. Leah's the older. Weak eyes. Weak eyes. Rachel, easy on the eyes, right? So you've got those two people, and Jacob has always preferred Rachel, but there was no collateral damage of that until he marries Leah. Now there's collateral damage. The interesting thing is, God has promised that out of you will come all these nations, and it's going to come out of this unbelievably dysfunctional family. In fact, we're going to meet 11 in what I'm just about going to read here in Act 3. We're about to see the relationship between Leah and Rachel and how unbelievably angry, jealous, and manipulative it is. It's crazy. We're going to meet 11 of the kids that are born, sons and a daughter, one daughter, and there's another son later on, chapter 35 or 36, comes one more son. So there comes the 12 sons of Israel, becomes the 12 tribes of Israel, and not one of them is born in love. Not one of them. That's the start of Israel. Here we go. Middle of chapter 29. When the Lord's, by the way, as I read this, J- just notice not only just the facts, because you're going to meet all the kids when all the kids are born, but the author, I believe Moses here, as he wrote this, he wants you to understand the pain, because this is just not insignificant little details here. It doesn't just say, well, then first was born Reuben and da-da-da-da-da-da. It doesn't say it. It gives all these details about the pain of what this family was like. When the Lord saw that Leah was not loved, ow, okay, he opened her womb. But Rachel was barren. So you got Leah is not loved, but she's fertile. And Rachel is loved, but she's barren. Leah became pregnant and gave birth to a son. She named him Reuben. For she said, it is because the Lord has seen my misery. Surely my husband will love me now. Did you hear that statement? They say it out loud. Surely my husband will now love me. Now, the names of all the kids have, they're like play on words. So this one, Reuben, means seen my misery or like my misery, okay? And all of them will do that. And they describe what they are, and it basically goes like that. But listen to the motivation. She's not loved. Lord opens her womb. She has the firstborn, the first child that's going to be part of this big nation, Reuben. And it says, guess what? Now I hope my husband will love me. It's like a couple going through big-time marital difficulties, and they say, we can't seem to get along at all. I know. Let's have a child. That'll fix it. It's a mess. That's what's going on here. It continues. She conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, because the Lord heard that I am not loved, he gave me this one too. So she named him Simeon, which Simeon means the one who hears. Again, she conceived, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, now at last my husband will become attached to me. Listen to the pain of that, saying I'm an unattached woman. I am not a woman who my husband has an affection for, because I have borne him three sons. So he was named Levi, and Levi means attached. She conceived again, and when she gave birth to a son, she said, this time I will praise the Lord. So she named him Judah. Then she stopped having children. So she gives him four sons. All right, now, I assume, I don't know, if you can get, how often get pregnant, how soon after having a child can you get pregnant? I suppose theoretically right away, but I mean probably realistically 6 months or whatever. Let's just give a minimum, let's say 2 months, and it's 10-month pregnancy, so that would be 4 years. 4 years have gone by in this total dysfunction, and she keeps bearing children to someone who doesn't really love her. Oh, I'm sorry, that's Judy. Yeah, okay, now we come to, well, how does Rachel feel about this? When Rachel saw that she was not bearing Jacob any children, now it's not like she just all of a sudden realized, I'm not bearing him any children. I mean, this is something that has gone on, and there's been like a pot of water that's boiling more and more, and she sees Leah, you know, first she's got the stroller, then she's got the double. And she's got a trailer on for the third one. Then she's got the youngest one kind of pushing on it. And she says, oh, well, how are you, Rachel? Me and my boys are out for a walk from that our husband impregnated us by. What are you going to do today? This was life in the Jacob household. And so it says she became jealous of her sister, incensed with anger. Incensed with jealousy. And then it says, she goes to Jacob, and he says, give me children or I'll die. Now, this is one of those moments where there's no husband words at that moment. But he says, he became angry with her and said, am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children? In other words, I went to Pastor Steve's premarital. I know where babies come from. They're just not happening, okay? It's not my deal. Then she said, I got an idea, she says. Here is Bilhah, my maidservant. Sleep with her so that she can bear children for me, and that through her, I can build a family. Now, she thinks, taking matters into her own hands, this is going to solve her problem. She's not going to be bummed out any longer that Leah has all these kids. And so she gave him her servant Bilhah as a wife. Jacob slept with her, and she became pregnant and bore him a son. Then Rachel said, God has vindicated me. He has listened to my plea and given me a son. Because of this, she named him Dan, which means he is vindicated. Now, you think, oh, it's all is right with Rachel now. Not even close. You're going to see as we keep going through it. This doesn't solve the issue. There's all this jealousy and strife going on. Rachel's servant Bilhah conceived again and bore Jacob a second son. Then Rachel said, I have had a great struggle with my sister, and I have won. She named him Naphtali, which means my struggle. In other words, now, okay, Leah might have four, but I got two. But she hasn't won anything. You're going to see in just a little bit. It's nothing has been won for her. Now we go back to Leah. It's like tennis. Back to you. Leah saw that she had stopped having children, so she took her maidservant Zilpah and gave her to Jacob as a wife. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a son. Then Leah said, what good fortune? So she named him Gad. So now we got the four kids plus the one, five Leah, three Rachel. Leah's servant Zilpah bore Jacob a second son. Then Leah said, how happy I am. Never been happy a day of your married life, your girl. The woman will call me happy. The women will call me happy. So she named him Asher, which means happy. And I know we've had a couple Ashers here at Hope. And it's a great name, happy, right? Now, you think, okay, all is good now, right? No, not even close. During wheat harvest, Reuben, firstborn kid, years have gone by here. He's old enough, so he's out in the fields doing harvesting. And he found some mandrake plants. Now, if you remember from the Song of Solomon series, it talks about bring the mandrake plants. When I say mandrake, in your mind, some smooth jazz would start to happen. Mandrakes are love potion number nine. You know, it's like an aphrodisiac. It's like, how you doing, right? That's mandrakes, which he brought to his mother. And Leah, Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes. But she said to her, wasn't it enough that you took away my husband? Now, you hear that pain? She's married first to him, and now you took his heart. Will you take my son's mandrakes too? And this is how it keeps getting more and more dysfunctional. Very well, Rachel said. He can sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes. Okay. So when Jacob came in from the fields that evening, Leah went out to meet with him, and guess what she says? You must sleep with me tonight. I have hired you. This is in the Bible, okay? I'm not making this stuff up. I have hired you with my son's mandrake. So he slept with her that night. God listened to Leah, and she became pregnant and bore Jacob a fifth son. Then Leah said, God has rewarded me for giving my maidservant to my husband. So she named him Issachar, which means reward. And then she conceives again. And we don't know if it's more mandrakes or what the deal is here, but she conceives again and bore Jacob a sixth son. Then Leah said, God has presented me with a precious gift. This time my husband will treat me with honor because he never has before. He sleeps with me all the time. He sleeps with anything that we put before him. Because I've borne six sons. So she named him Zebulun, which means honor. Sometime later, she gave birth to a daughter and named her Dinah. So it's a lot of boys, and there's finally this girl. Then God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb. So finally, Rachel's womb is opened. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son and said, God has taken away my disgrace. See, up until that moment, none of this other stuff was satisfying. Even this doesn't satisfy. It's still this tension. She names him Joseph and said, may the Lord add to me another son. And he does. Later on in chapter 35, Benjamin will be born, the last child of the family. And so you'll have two from Rachel, six from Leah, and then four from the different maidservants for a total of 12. And if you wonder why, we'll talk about this next week, why those 12 sons are such an unruly bunch, you can just look what the dinner conversations were about. Wasn't about, oh, what did you do today, Zebulun? No, it's who's selling mandrakes so I can hire your dad tonight? That's what the conversation was around the table. These people were messed up. Unbelievably messed. This is cable TV reality show all over it right here. Act 4. Deceit continues. the deceit continues. I like this right here. There's a it's an office, and some lady said, she wrote on here, ring found, and they give a picture of the ring. It's found in the women's bathroom if you can't see it. And then they give contact information, you know, go to this number or call this extension if this is your ring. And then somebody writes down, nice try, Sauron. I'm going to fall for your little hobbits, tricksters. Not going to do that. So deceit, it's all over the place. After Rachel, this is the end of chapter 30 now. After Rachel gave birth to Joseph, Jacob said to Laban, send me on my way so that I can go back to my own homeland. Give me my wives and children for whom I have served you, and I'll be on my way. You know how much work I've done for you. But Laban says to him, if I have found favor in your eyes, please stay. I have, this sentence alone is crazy. I have learned by divination, I've learned by pagan gods, that the Lord, the real God, has blessed me because of you. Wow. He added, name your wages and I will pay them. And he's like, I've been on that rodeo before. But he falls for it again. He says, you know how I've worked for you and how your livestock has fared under my care. The little you had before I came has increased greatly, and the Lord has blessed you wherever I've been. But now, when may I do something for my own household? He says, what shall I give you? Name your wages. Don't give me anything. But if you will do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. Let me go through all your flocks today. There's the loophole, by the way. There's the loophole. Let me go through your flocks today and remove from them every speckled or spotted sheep and every dark-colored lamb and every spotted or speckled goat. In other words, I'll just take the ones that have the speckles on it, and they're not the most valuable ones, besides, obviously, the milk and the meat we get out of it. You have wool, and this is not as fancy. I'll take the lower end. That'll be my wages. That'll be my wages. And my honesty will testify for me. I mean, I wonder how Laban even heard that sentence and believed it. But anyway, it says, my honesty will testify for me in the future. Whenever you check on the wages, you have paid me. Any goat in my possession that is not speckled or spotted, or any lamb that is not dark-colored, will be considered stolen. So Laban says, agreed. Let it be as you have said. That same day, that's Laban, removed all the male goats that were streaked or spotted, and all the speckled or spotted female goats, all that had white on them, and all the dark-colored lambs, and he placed them in the care of his sons. Well, what was the agreement? Well, you do it today. But I might have somewhere else I'm going to put them today. And then if you get them later, that's fine. Oh, my gosh. Then he put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob. Yeah, you better run. While Jacob continued to tend the rest of Laban's flocks. Jacob, however, has something up his sleeve. He took fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees and made white strips on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood of the branches. Then he placed the peeled branches in all the watering troughs so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they made it in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. Why that works, I have no idea. Jacob set apart the young of the flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streaked and dark-colored animals that belonged to Laban. Thus, he made separate flocks for himself and did not put them with Laban's animals. Whenever the stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches in the troughs in front of the animals so they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak, he would not place them there. So now, that's deceptive too, because he said, hey, I'll just take the ones that are... He's actually like, not only just making more of them that are spotted, he is putting the strong for him and the weak ones for Laban. So the weak animals went to Laban and the strong ones to Jacob. In this way, the man, Jacob, grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks and maidservants and men servants and camels and donkeys. This is the guy that is the one that is told later on in this account, no longer will your name be Jacob, you will be Israel, for you, a nation will come out of you. Really? Now, I'm gonna follow some themes here in just a minute, but let's not miss the big point here. What's the big point? God uses very messed up people. God uses very messed up people. You cannot read this and say in any way, shape, or form that other than a very strong work ethic, you can see that he has that. A very poor businessman, but a very strong work ethic. There's very little to be proud of about Jacob, right? He's got the sexual ethics of a dog. He is all over the place with his business practices. He's lied and deceived his brothers. I mean, there's nothing really admirable about this guy at all. And yet God uses him. That's the big idea. Now, there are some themes that are further developed in the Bible here. Okay? There are some themes. First one, is bigamy a viable option? I always get this question when we're studying the Old Testament, this comes up. People say, why did God allow that in the Old Testament? Second thing that comes up is deception okay? Is deception okay? Because it sure seems like God blesses this somehow. And then lastly, there's this theme clearly of being unloved and the power of love and how it changes a person. So let's take those one at a time. First one, bigamy. The frightening thing to say, and it is true, is that the Bible nowhere forbids polygamy. Doesn't. Not flat out saying, don't do it. Okay? But I think it makes it clear the intention, but it doesn't ever forbid it. In fact, it just kind of announces it. First time is in Genesis chapter 4, and it says that Lamech married two different women, and it gives their names there. Just kind of announces it as the descendants of Cain. Okay? Then in Leviticus 18, it even kind of talks about, perhaps even when the Moses comes in and the law is made, that it kind of, it shows, maybe don't do what Jacob did. That caused a lot of problems. It says, do not take your wife's sister as a rival wife and have sexual relations with her while your wife is living. Now that just, it's amazing that it even has to be a law. But it is, and it's a way to say this is really foolish and it will lead to a lot of disharmony. But it's interesting that it doesn't just say, hey, don't take second wives. A lot of theories on why that is. A lot to do perhaps due to the way warfare was in those days, and that there were a lot of dead men, and so there were a lot of excess women. Could be. I don't know. But was that God's intention? So let's go back to God's intention. Genesis 2:24. We started this third week. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother, and be united to his wife, and they'll become one flesh. Genesis 2:24, I think, makes it really clear what God's intention is. The problem in Genesis chapter 2 was that there was aloneness on the part of Adam, and he creates Eve, and they come together. And then the author of Genesis, probably Moses, steps back and says, because of this, this now sets in place marriage. And what is marriage meant to be? A man leaving and cleaving and being united to his wife, and they become one flesh. One flesh, two people. So it seems to me that's clear. By the time you get to the New Testament, there's some changes. There's some changes in the culture. First of all, the Romans absolutely hated polygamy. So it was not a good thing. But there's even changes within the Jewish culture. It's not at all seen as an okay thing. In fact, so when you get to setting up leadership in the churches, Paul's talking about leadership here in 1 Timothy chapter 3, and he says, here's a trustworthy saying. If anyone sets his heart on being an overseer, he desires a noble task. Now the overseer must be, and he lists a bunch of things, above reproach, the husband of but one wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach. Now, a lot of people have taken this different ways, saying they must be married or they must not have like families all over the place. that maybe they've divorced from or just left. But I think in the context, I think one of the clear things it's saying is you're not a bigamist. You're not married to multiple wives. You are a one-woman man. I think that's what it's saying. You are a one-woman man. And by the time you then get on to Ephesians where Paul is talking about marriage, nowhere does it talk in the plural about spouses, unless he's talking to a group. He says in Ephesians chapter 5, he says, wives, submit to your husbands. So I guess that's possible. They're all married to each other in a networky kind of way. But he says, then it goes singular. For the husband, singular, is the head of the wife. And now here's the example. As Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he's the Savior, singular. Husbands, love your wives. Now again, he's speaking to a group. And it doesn't say, husband, love your wives, or husbands, love your wife. It says, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So it's one Christ and one church to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any of the blemish, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives, their own bodies. He, singular, who loves his wife, singular, loves himself, singular. And he goes back to saying where this all comes from. And he quotes from Genesis 2. For this reason, a man, singular, will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, singular, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I'm saying that marriage is really an analogy of Christ and the church. However, each one, singular, I know you're getting sick of me saying that, but must love his wife, singular, and loves himself, and the wife, singular, must respect her husband, singular. So it seems real clear that this is, it's gone in the New Testament. Nowhere is it advocated for, even said it's acceptable. So it seems to me that Genesis 2 sets the pattern, the fall happens, and for whatever reason, God allows it to take place. Allows a lot of stuff to take place that later on is not seen as his design. Bigamy, first thing. Not a lot of, the only application point is don't get married to two people. Now, really, okay, little more in line with applicable points, deception. Is it okay to be deceptive? Does the Old Testament teach, and as we go through the Bible, let it crescendo, what does it teach in the New Testament? In the Old Testament, if you were to read just the Jacob account, you would think that it's okay to lie. You just think, well, that's just the way you do things. It's okay to be tricksy. It's okay to manipulate contracts. Not the Old Testament is very clear. By the time you get to Moses and the writing of the law, very clear. Do not steal. Do not lie. Let me explain what I mean by do not lie. Do not lie means do not deceive one another. Okay? That means you can tell the truth and still lie. Those are all true statements, but it led you to believe something else. It's called deception. Lying is telling, are you really Esau? Well, yes, I am. That's a lie. Okay? Deception is where you tell truth, but you give it the old Texas twist there. You know what I'm saying? And it ain't being heard what you actually said. Do not swear falsely by my name, and so profane the name of the Lord your God. I am the Lord. Proverbs 28, do not testify against your neighbor without cause or use your lips to deceive. This is a big deal. Because when Jesus comes on the scene, Jesus comes on the scene as a lot of things, and it's used in a lot of different ways. He talks about himself as truth. I am truth, right? He also talks about himself as light. In John chapter 3, he's talking with Nicodemus, and he says, this is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but people love darkness and deceit and dysfunction. Instead of light, why? Because their deeds were evil. Everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come into the light for fear that their deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes into the light so that it may be seen plainly that what they have done has been done in the sight of God. So there's something about when Jesus comes on the scene about, no, absolutely no deception. Paul goes to write about this and says, but now you must rid yourself of all such things as these. And he gives a list, anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. And then he says this and he explains why. Do not lie to each other. Why? Since you are no longer your old self, you've taken off your old self with its practices and have put on the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge in the image of its creator. That's amazing. Paul could have just said, don't lie. Why? Because I said so. He doesn't. He says that there's something about deception and lying that is inconsistent with the gospel. When I'm going to be deceitful or lie, what's really happening? There's something going on within my heart that says, if you knew the truth right now, that would somehow reflect badly on me, one way, shape, or form. So even though it's maybe just a little white lie, somehow that's going to reflect on me. And when the gospel comes, now I can speak truthfully. And when grandma says to me, do you like the mashed potatoes? You can say, grandma, these are the worst mashed potatoes I've ever had in my life. But grandma, I love you like there ain't no tomorrow. I don't think I'm ever going to let you make mashed potatoes again, but I love you. But not your mashed potatoes. The gospel comes in and says, speak truthfully and lovingly. Because if grandma is equating mashed potatoes with love, then grandma's got an idol. And I'm there to speak truth and love to her and not fulfill her mashed potato idol. Do not apply this. Truth sets you free. Somebody's got to tell her. The terrible, wateriest things ever seen. White gravy. Something happens when the gospel comes in and I'm able to speak now because I'm no longer a coward. Because that's what a liar really is. It's a coward. Can't face the truth. Last one. Power of love, and then we'll close. You and I are created by God for relationships. You see, you can just watch it in that account in Genesis 29 and half of 30 where the spouses and the maidservants, they don't get to say anything. But can you just imagine what that would have been like? To have to be given over and have someone else's child? I mean, ugh. You could see it in all these reality programs if you watch those things. And you can just see the interpersonal pain that people have. Because we're created by God to be loved by Him and to love Him and to be loved by others and to love others. That's what we're created by. Created for. And yet, because we live in a fallen world, it's all messed up. Proverbs 17, I love this. It doesn't talk about in a marriage relationship. It just talks about a friendship. And he says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. In other words, they're going to stick through you through thick and thin. They're with you. I love you. I care for you. I'm in this with you. That's what love is. It's a giving of yourself wholeheartedly to another individual. And how do you do that? Well, you do it, not to sound like a broken record, but you do it by the gospel. Look what 1 John says. Dear friends, let us love one another. Why? For love comes from God. Now he's going to explain what that means. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only Son into the world that we might live through him. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us. What's this saying? This is saying, how do you love one another? If you really want to think about it, you could just say, just love one another. No. What really does it, though, is if I know from my very toes that no matter what, I am loved by an almighty God, even though I'm as messed up as Jacob, I'm loved by an almighty God, and Christ died for every shortcoming and every failure and every shame in my life. Every one of them are on the cross. And when I get that straight, and I'm okay, and I'm secure in this, now I can actually love others, perhaps some of whom are going to reject me. But it's okay. I'm still going to move forward in love because I'm set in the gospel, setting me free. Look what it says here. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we're going to go to communion in just a little bit. This screams to you. God loves you at your Jacob worst. your worst. He comes and he ministers to you. And he says, I'll die for you. For you, Jacob. For me, Jacob. I'll die for you. That's what this table says. That's where we're going to move right now. So let me close and ask you this. If that's the case, if that's who Christ is, if that's what he's done, if that's what this all means, then will we come out of this dysfunctional, crazy, manipulative, deceitful background and say, Jesus Christ, I come into your light? Ponder that. Whatever that means in your life today, I can't tell you what that means. You know. Let the Holy Spirit speak to you as you prepare for a time of response in worship and communion.